Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're in session 152, repeating history, the comparing of the 1953 and 2008 raids on the FLDS. And I'm Perry Porter, and I'm just chairing the session. I want to remind you, if you have any cell phones or pagers or et cetera, that might disrupt the recording, to remember to put them in silent or turn them off. Ken Driggs is an attorney living in Atlanta, Georgia. That's still accurate?
Yes.
And he's spoken at Sunstone in the past and is familiar with this topic. He also is author of a book, Evil Among Us, and he's going to leave plenty of time for questions and answers, period. So if you have thoughts during the time, make mental note or take personal note. And so we'll take the questions and answers a little bit later on, and we'll go straight to Ken because he has a lot to share with us.
Good afternoon. I put my email address here on a slip on the front, maybe too small for most of you to read. I did that because I'm more than happy to communicate with people if you have questions or interest in this subject. I'm trying to get a website up to post some of the stuff I've published on this and some of my source materials. But my email address is kendriggs, K-E-N-D-R-I-G-G-S, at comcast.net. That's obviously a home address. What I thought I'd do today is start by telling you a little bit about my involvement with this subject, and then I'm going to go and talk about both of the two raids and some comparison of them. I am a criminal defense lawyer. I'm a public defender in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a sixth-generation Mormon. I have a lot of polygamy in my family tree, which is part of my interest here. And I have, first time I ever visited Colorado City was in January 1988. Basically, I saw something on 60 Minutes, I think, was the first time I saw anything about it. And I've lived my whole life in the Deep South. I never even knew there were fundamentalist Mormons when I saw that piece. And went there and kind of talked my way in and developed some friendships with people who later got excommunicated by Warren Jeffs, but people in sort of the leadership cadre of the community down there. And at the time, I had started researching and writing about a long series of United States Supreme Court decisions about Mormon polygamy in the 1800s. The first time the U.S. Supreme Court ever dealt with the religion clauses in the First Amendment was in the Mormon cases, beginning with Reynolds in 1879 and a whole string of them up into the 1890s. We lost most of them. And I started writing about them, and then I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin for a degree in legal history. That's in the law school as opposed to a PhD program. And I was planning on writing on one of these 19th century Mormon subjects, and my major professor pointed out to me a very mean-spirited 1955 Utah Supreme Court decision called In Re Black. It had to do with the parental rights of a plural wife in Colorado City. It was an outgrowth of the 53 raid. And I'm going to talk about that, I guess, in sequence when I get to that point in the thing. But so I ended up doing a pretty saturation study of that decision and was pretty surprised at some of the stuff I found, basically misconduct on the part of the state. And as a consequence of that, I've ended up, this has practically been a second career for me, looking at fundamentalist Mormons. I've been an expert witness three times in hearings or trials that involve the FLDS. I've spoken about it a lot. I've published a lot of articles. One day I will make myself pull all this together in a book. And I have chapters in two books that are coming out in the next year or so that are anthologies about the FLDS. I will say that I have a lot of friends in that community. I freely admit to some sympathies for those folks, so whatever you take from me, you should, I guess, be forewarned about that. I know Warren Jeffs a little bit. And many of the other people who were involved in some of these things. So, and when I visited down there in those communities, for the last several years, I usually stay with families in there who have been kind enough to invite me into their home. And I'm telling you, you learn an awful lot more sitting around a dinner table and playing with people's kids than you do in sort of a sterile reading transcripts of newspaper articles and looking at hearings setting. So I think I have a pretty good feel for what community life is like down there, and personally feel like it is very different from the public stereotype which isn't to say that they don't have a lot of problems down there, and they have, and some of those problems have been brought on them by their current leadership, but that doesn't mean that everybody's a bad guy. Okay, having said that, let me start by talking a little bit about how the law was used against polygamy cases and fundamentalist Mormons before the 53 raid. For those of you that don't know a lot about fundamentalist Mormon history, they kind of coalesced in the late 1920s under a priesthood council, a body of men that were called by a man named Lawrence C. Woolley. They believed that they were acting on the authority of essentially President John Taylor and a vision that he had in 1886, and that they were commanded to see that not a generation passed without children being born under the covenant, meaning under celestial marriage, plural marriage. And at the time, in the 1800s, the church, when the church said celestial marriage, it meant plural marriage. It's only a modern definition of the term that is monogamous marriage. So this body comes together in the early 1930s. It is sort of a loose organization. They didn't dictate in every aspect of people's lives by any means, but it was a place for these folks, these traditional Mormons, to rally. And in about 1934-35, the little bitty pioneer hamlet, it's really too small to even call a village, of Short Creek, had some people who made connections with this priesthood body, and they invited the priesthood council to colonize Short Creek as a kind of a haven to avoid legal pressures against polygamous families, and also to experiment with United Order living. And this is right in the middle of the Depression, too, which had hit Utah pretty hard. And they pretty much captured the little LDS branch down, which resulted in pretty much everybody in the branch, or at least all the main families in the branch, being excommunicated from the church. And in 1935, you have your first trial, criminal trial, of polygamous, at least modern, sort of post-manifesto period, where two men get convicted and are sent to prison. A smattering of criminal prosecutions, generally for an unlawful cohabitation statute, follow after that. 35 trials, by the way, were in Arizona for Arizona authorities. You get up to 1940, where there is a Utah Supreme Court decision overturning the conviction of someone in Washington County. It's Jessup versus State. For those of you that look these things up, it's at 100 Pacific 2nd, 969. They throw out the conviction for insufficient evidence. And you also get some pressure on people for not paying child support or not supporting their children, but not really a lot of serious prosecutions of great numbers of people, until 1944. And one thing that's important in the interim is in 1935, the Utah legislature elevated the crime of unlawful cohabitation from a misdemeanor to a felony. It carried, I think, a 5-year prison sentence. So in 1944, you have a multi-state, federal and state prosecution, where I believe they ultimately arrested 44, 45 people, including women. There were federal trials and state trials. A group of men got 5-year prison sentences. They were mostly paroled at about 8 years. There was a handful that refused to sign some declarations of state law and ended up serving more. But that was a pretty big deal. And the interesting thing about that 44 raid is that 3 cases get up to the United States Supreme Court out of that raid. That's the first time the Supreme Court had held on the issue since the Mormon cases in the 1880s. They held that one group of men were not guilty of kidnapping for moving a young plural wife around. They did hold that the interstate transport of women for polygamous marriages was an immoral act covered by the Mann Act, the White Slave Act. And the interesting thing about that is that opinion is authored by William O. Douglas, who later becomes the great champion of civil liberties in the Supreme Court, but on that case, he was not. And there's a third case where the Supreme Court held that Utah's conspiracy law was pretty vague and they couldn't prosecute the conspiracy without more direction from the Utah Supreme Court, and they sent it back to Utah, and by then all the people had been paroled, so that case just kind of died. Okay, all of those matters are pretty much criminal, and they're sporadic and never involve large numbers of people. Well, then comes the 1953 raid in Short Creek. There are actually two publications of interest in that area. If you're interested in reading about it, Martha Bradley has a book called Kidnapped from That Land, The Government Raids on the Short Creek Polygamous. It was published by the University of Utah Press. It's still in print. It's pretty good. She did a lot of interviews with people who were involved in that. And I had an article in the Utah Historical Quarterly in the winter 1992 issue, which is essentially a digest of my LLM thesis that's mostly about the Vera Black case. But there had been some complaints about the people in Short Creek to government authorities, in particular some Superior Court judges and local ranchers who apparently resented paying property taxes to pay for the school in Short Creek to educate children there. The total property taxes paid was about $7,000 a year, but it was enough to, I guess, annoy the ranchers. And they were making complaints to the governor. So a pretty elaborate investigation was initiated. The legislature appropriated money under the line item of, I think it was cricket control or something like that, insect control. And the money went to, initially, to hire the Burns Detective Agency out of Los Angeles. And they come up to Short Creek, and they say, we're here scouting for a movie that's going to be shot in this area. We're looking at locations. And so what they do is they do essentially a chart of the town. This is how many people live in this house. This is how many families, how many adults and kids. And they turn that fairly detailed chart over to law enforcement. And then on July 26th, I guess it is, 26th or 24th, of 1953, this big caravan of law enforcement and about 100 press people in cars come up to Short Creek. Now, mind you, at the time, there are no paved roads. There's one phone line that gets cut before they come in. And so it wasn't like a easy place to get to. And some sympathetic law enforcement officer and possibly other people had tipped off the Short Creek people that this was coming. So it was no surprise to them. And they had some scouts posted out around the town to look for this cavalcade when it came in. And I think the vehicles had their lights out. And one of those scouts was a guy named Dan Barlow, who's actually a friend of mine. Dan used to be mayor of Colorado City for a long time. He was out on Barry Knoll. And if any of you have been following the newspaper coverage of this UEP litigation about whether they're going to sell some land to pay bills for the United Effort Plan Trust down there, the parcel of land they're talking about selling is Barry Knoll, where this scout was. And they had some sort of explosive charge, some dynamite or something, which they set off, and that let everybody in town know that here come the cops. And so when the police come into town, they find Leroy Johnson, who was essentially the leader of the community at that point, and pretty much the whole populace in the square in front of this little one-room schoolhouse they have, singing hymns and patriotic songs, ready to be detained. So they essentially arrest. They have warrants for all the adults and take custody orders for all of the kids. And after the law enforcement arrive, a little later on, the National Guard comes in with a field cooking kitchen, and they set that up. And they have some judges with them, and they begin these detention proceedings. They arrest virtually every adult. They take into custody virtually every child and the mothers of the children. And they are all eventually shipped off to Phoenix and other metropolitan locations in Arizona, where child protection proceedings are begun against them, dependency proceedings. And it's tied up down there for months. And Utah really didn't participate in the raid on the Utah side. There were 27 people, I think, that were detained in Utah and then extradited back to Arizona. But there was a family in Utah. Leonard Black had three plural wives. One of his plural wives was a woman named Vera Black, who is still alive, is 93 years old, and will outlive me, I'm quite certain. She's a very interesting interview about this. And she had eight children at the time. She had two subsequent to this and eight at the time. And the Washington County Juvenile Court initiates a child dependency action. And the allegation is that the children are dependent, they're neglected and being abused by virtue of the fact that they live in a polygamous home and their parents are teaching them that plural marriage is a proper way to live, that this is the religious instruction they have. There's no allegation that they're beating them up or they're not feeding them or they're not clothed or anything like that. The sole allegation is the religious instruction going on in the home. And the things that I was able to find through a very able research assistant was that before the hearing took place, there was this communication back channel between the authorities. The blacks had a lawyer. And when you have counsel, you're represented, you're entitled to know certain things about the proceeding and know about communications with the judge. In particular, there should never be anything called ex parte, which is where one side lobbies the judge and the other side doesn't know about it and doesn't have a chance to respond. Well, at some point, a prosecutor in Arizona writes the juvenile court judge in Washington County and says, hey, what are you planning on doing on these cases? And the juvenile judge writes back saying, I don't think it's proper for you to be talking to me about this. You know, this is a pending case in front of the court. This is an ex parte communication. So that prosecutor in Arizona then writes the attorney general and some other authorities in Salt Lake and says, hey, this guy's not with a program. Somebody needs to sit on his head and get him to do right. And so that juvenile judge is then summoned to Salt Lake City for a meeting with the powers that be. And he's told, this is how you will decide this case. And here is a form order we have prepared. You will sign your name here, and you'll fill in the name of the kids up here. And this is all happening before the proceeding, outside of the counsel for Vera Black doesn't know about this. And the juvenile judge is sort of chastised and goes back to Short Creek, and they have the hearing, and he ends up signing the dependency order exactly as written by these powers that be in Salt Lake. The shock to me was that nobody thought this was improper, and they were confident enough about it to set it all out in memorandums and letters. There is a paper trail that documents all of this that's we found in the Utah State Archives. Today, you would be disbarred for that kind of conduct. At that point in time, I guess people figured they're only polygamous, it doesn't matter. Then Vera Black is told, if you will sign this pledge swearing to essentially forsake your religious affiliation and not raise your children in this way, we'll give you your kids back. If you don't, we're going to terminate your parental rights and we're going to adopt them out. And Vera Black said, no, I'm not going to do that. So it ends up going to the Utah Supreme Court, and in 1955 they decide this case called In Re Black. And if anybody is interested in this, the citation to it is In Re Black, 283 Pacific 2nd, 887, Utah, 1955. And it's a unanimous opinion that affirms the termination of her parental rights. And essentially, the majority opinion says these people are such lowlifes, they are not entitled to children under any circumstances, and it is never improper for the state to terminate their parental rights. That was the leading case on Utah parental rights issues that involve plural families until an adoption case that came up in the early 1990s that came out of Short Creek, out of Colorado City, that didn't mention In Re Black, but it had the effect of pretty much overturning In Re Black. But to finish out Vera Black's story, the state then comes in and takes her kids. And there's lots of media covering it, and all the kids are crying and hanging onto their mama's legs, and they're getting dragged off by the state authorities. It ended up being a public relations nightmare for the state of Utah. And after some pushing and shoving, she eventually gets her children back about a year and a half, I think, after the decision. And again, she is asked to sign this pledge. She does sign the pledge, says, okay, you know, I want my children back. I will renounce my religion. She promptly goes back to Colorado City, you know, and moves back with her husband, raises her kids. They're all still down there and are members of that community. Leonard Black, her husband, has died. I think her two sister wives have both died, one of whom was actually her biological sister. But Vera is still alive, living with one of the two sons that were born after the raid. You know, and in terms of her life, nothing changed. As to the criminal charges in the 53 raid, there were, I think, 60 men involved that eventually pled to misdemeanors, and they worked out a deal with the state where all charges would be dismissed against the women and a number of other men, and these guys all got put on probation for 12 months, and basically nothing changed after that was over. It was such a kind of a political nightmare for the state, I think, PR-wise and cost-wise. I think it ended up costing the state of Arizona around $2 million for the period of time that they had the children in protective custody there. And eventually those cases were thrown out because they had denied counsel to the parents of those children. When they had hearings, they said you couldn't have a lawyer. You have to speak for yourself, which is, by today's standards, is pretty unconstitutional. It may have been a little more of a gray area then. They ended up, finally a court in Arizona ruled that that was not proper and they had to release all the children, and they did. And the state just didn't want to take up the baton again. And the governor of Arizona, who had been very adamant about pushing the raid, lost the next election, his run for re-election. And one of the issues against him was what a disaster that raid was. And so it became sort of a political third rail for a lot of people afterwards. So that's basically the 53 raid. It was started off primarily criminal, but it ended up involving the rights of parents. And that was the first time that any state entity that I've found has used parental rights as a way to sort of deal with fundamentalist Mormons. You have a few more arrests that are all criminal in the mid-50s. A few more prison sentences. They all involve what fundamentalists call independents, people who are not affiliated with individual groups. One of the effects of the 53 raid is it scared the devil out of the fundamentalist Mormon community. Everybody went underground. The message they sort of learned was the state is not your friend. Officers are not your friend. Don't involve yourself with the police. Don't involve yourself with social service agencies. Stay out of sight. And it really was a couple of generations before fundamentalist Mormons got confident enough again to kind of come back up to the surface and be a little more public and live a little more publicly with their children. And their numbers increased considerably in that period of time. And then along comes the yearning for Zion Ranch in Texas. Let me give you just a little bit of background on how I think they ended up in Texas. Warren Jeffs used to be headmaster of the Alta Academy up here in the Salt Lake Valley. And then moved back down while his father was older. His father was ruling Jeffs and was the head of the group. His father had become quite infirm and elderly, and Warren goes back and ends up essentially being his spokesman and administering the church. And at some point, then when his father dies, Warren, a few months after the father, is formally confirmed as the president and prophet of the FLDS Church. There was some speculation that there might be a power struggle and he might not be the leader. I don't think there was any question within the FLDS community. I think it was probably pretty clear to all that Warren was going to succeed his father. And that's actually a little bit of an anomaly. Father-to-son succession was not a practice in the groups in the fundamentalist Mormon community. This is the only time I've ever seen that happen, with the exception, I guess, of the Kingston family. But at any rate, at some point, a cousin of his and another person who said, we were students as children in the Alta Academy, and we were sexually assaulted by Warren Jeffs and another one of his brothers. And they sued. And it's one of these past memory refresh kind of thing. You know, 20 years later, oh yeah, now I remember this happening. And as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm exceedingly suspicious of those kinds of claims. But they sue him civilly. And they sue the United Effort Plan. Now, they have this a trust, a legal entity that owns the title to their assets in Colorado City. If you live there, chances are you live in a UEP home. The lot belongs to the church, the United Effort Plan. The business you may build belongs to the church. And you live there essentially at sufferance of the church. You give substantial donations of your income, in theory, based on your ability to pay, and that goes into the coffers of the church. So the UEP is now estimated to have assets around $100 million. You know, that assumes somebody wants to buy that stuff in a remote area. I think that's kind of a fishy way to value some of that property. But so this tort suit sues the UEP and Warren. Now, the UEP, when these bad acts are supposed to have happened, Warren is not an employee of the United Effort Plan. He is not on their board of directors. He has no formal affiliation with them at all, which means that the UEP has no tort liability for his conduct. You can only be sued for the conduct of somebody you have some responsibility for, some vicarious control over. So it would have been a relatively simple matter, I think. I'm not a civil lawyer, but I think it would have been a simple matter for attorneys for the UEP to file an action to have them dismissed and have the suit proceed only against Warren Jeffs, who had minimal assets for anybody to get to. But Warren apparently instructed his attorneys not to answer. What that means is plaintiff wins by default. You don't answer, so he gets everything he's asked for, which meant conceivably plaintiffs could have gotten the whole UEP holdings. the trial judge in down in southern Utah where this was brought, they kept giving the Jeffs people, the FLDS, additional time to file an answer, and they never filed an answer. And the judge finally figured out these guys aren't going to answer. And the judge felt, I think properly so, that the people living in those homes on UEP land had a right to know that their houses may be about to get yanked out from under them. He didn't think they even knew they had some exposure here. And his remedy for that was to strip Warren Jeffs of his board, his position as head of the board of the UEP. And at this point, at the time of the suit, he does have this control over the UEP. At the time of the bad conduct, he does not. And the judge replaces them with a board of trustees who are not FLDS and include a kind of a trustee, I guess, a conservator to look after the property. So Warren Jeffs loses control over the UEP assets. And he loses essentially the leverage, or some of the leverage, over families living in UEP-owned homes. So they start buying up property in Texas, West Texas, in Colorado, in South Dakota. There are rumors about possibly in Mexico, but I don't think anybody's confirmed any of that. So they go to this little town in West Texas and buy up 1,700 acres. I think they paid $700,000 for the 17 acres. And then they start building up a pretty large community there. They build a temple. They build up enough that I think it ends up with a property, appraised property value of about $23 million. And I read in another Deseret News article that the property taxes from that FLDS-owned property now represent 18% of the total revenues of that county. So the county is now sort of dependent on revenues from them. But they're very closed off there. It was located in a remote area, and it wasn't where people could come in. There was a gate on the perimeter of it and restricted access to it. Well, at some point, I'll say this. When I first heard that they were locating out there, I've never been to that place, but I tracked down who the sheriff was and his address, and I wrote him and sent him some of the stuff that I'd published and some other stuff about the FLDS and made some suggestions to him about how to deal with these people in a reasonable way, and some suggestions about how not to deal with them, something that I thought would be unproductive. And he called me. We had a pretty long phone conversation on a couple of occasions. And then as things played out, they did exactly what I suggested they not do. The account is that on I guess March 28th of 2008, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services gets a call from a woman identifying herself as Sarah, saying she is 16 years old, she is a plural wife, and she's being physically and sexually abused by her husband, whom she identified as Dale Barlow. Well, there is a Dale Barlow. Dale Barlow is a son of Dan Barlow. He is actually on probation for a prior offense in Arizona, where he's not allowed to leave the state and has to report daily to his probation officer over there, which his probation officer verified he was. But without really verifying this information, the Texas authorities cranked up this raid. And 5 days later, on April 3rd at about 9 o'clock at night, they roll in to the compound, the ranch. And they initially pick up, I think, 52 kids. And then they just keep going. And they ended up seizing every child in the community, which was up over 450. And they arrested a handful of men. But the main thrust of that raid was not criminal. It was the parental rights and child abuse, sexual molestation kinds of allegations. And what they apparently did is they extrapolated from this one call, which they had not verified, that because of the nature of the community, every child in the community was either being abused or was going to be abused, and that they justified seizing them. And rather than leave the children in the community and tell the men, you got to go find another place to live, let's leave the kids here in areas that they are comfortable with and they know, they removed all the children. And for a while they had them in like National Guard armories and things like that, not a world the kids were very familiar with. And initially the authorities down there denied that they had come in sort of paramilitary, but some people in the community had cameras, and you start getting these photographs coming out of military half tracks, and the officers are all in bulletproof vests and automatic weapons. It looked like a pretty military operation. And the fundamentalists, the FLDS, started sort of getting their PR response up and got those photographs out, and it made the authorities look a little less than candid. And the other thing that I thought was sort of odd is I guess this community in Texas is a community that's almost exclusively Baptist. And I noticed when they're bussing the kids out of there, they're Baptist church buses. They're moving them out of. And all they've got the big First Baptist Church sign on the side. And to me, that suggests sort of a cultural insensitivity, that they just didn't understand the community that they were dealing with there. And, well, as it turns out, they eventually, fairly quickly, determined that the call was a hoax, that there is no Sarah. The call came from a woman in Iowa, I think, who had, or no, Colorado Springs, who is mentally ill and has a long history of making bogus phone calls like this. And apparently, I've never met her, but the news accounts I've read, there was a pretty big two-page article on her in Newsweek at some point, said that she had a multiple personality kind of disorder and apparently had a child abuse history herself and kept lapsing back into her abuse history and assumed all these identities and made these kind of calls pretty routinely. Colorado people were pretty familiar with her. Texas people obviously were not. So as Texas began to investigate, they started saying things like, we have all these kids with broken bones and broken limbs, and then they backed off of that. They hired a psychologist to assist and advise them in dealing with the kids, and I remember seeing this guy interviewed on CNN at one point, and I was just shocked to hear him say that we have to destroy these families to save them. I mean, it went back to that old Vietnam phrase that you had to essentially break down these families and dissolve them in order to save the families. I thought that was just a lunatic thing to say, but he said it on TV, so it must be true. You also had a story that just made me crazy. They go into the temple. These people have built a temple there that looks very much like the St. George Temple. And one of the things they reported was they found sex beds in the temple. And they were reporting that, CNN was reporting anyway, Anderson Cooper was the mouthpiece of this, that they believed that right after these plural marriages of underage brides to older men, they went straight to the sex bed in the temple and consummated the marriage right there in the presence of witnesses. And this was put out on TV news. I didn't see it in the print media much, but it sure came up on TV news. I was paying attention to this because I live in Atlanta. CNN is right there. It's not far from my office. And Court TV and a lot of those other cable networks have, I guess, studios, and they rent studios there. And when the raid broke, I was doing an awful lot of TV interviews in Atlanta. And pretty consistently, they would begin with some factual statement that was just, I thought, completely outrageous. It took me a while to figure out I shouldn't even respond to that stuff and just go ahead and say what I was going to say. And when Warren Jeffs had his trial, by the way, going on, Court TV broadcast all of it, and I was the talking head through most of that trial, me and another defense lawyer. So I heard most of the testimony in that trial and was actually a little surprised he was convicted. I think part of the problem with the TV news is that the news channels on cable are on these 24-hour news cycles. They got to have stuff up all the time. And the verification of what they put up there is just not on their plan. When they get it, they throw it up and see if it sticks. And if it turns out to be wrong, they just sort of back off and don't broadcast it anymore. I've never seen them come back and say, what we said yesterday about sex beds in the temple, not really true. They never do things like that. But I think it has to do with this 24-hour time pressure. I did take an awful lot of calls from print media and found them to be much more responsible and much more interested in trying to examine things and get the real story. Anyway, to the benefit, this Dale Barlow guy I mentioned, who this caller alleges is her abuser, fairly quickly they're able to determine that he'd never left the state of Arizona and he doesn't know this woman and it's had nothing to do with it. And that gets verified about the same time they finally decide there is no Sarah. They take DNA swabs from everybody and they're telling the parents of the children, we're not going to return your kids until we know for sure that they're your kids and we're going to have to do a DNA matchup. Well, the criminal lawyer in me sees all kinds of red flags going up with that. I'm thinking, they're not going to use that DNA in child custody issues. They're going to try to use that in criminal prosecutions at some later date. And I know there are search and seizure issues going on with that stuff now. But to their credit, Texas Legal Services came in and represented most of the parents. And a lot of lawyers volunteered and did free work representing the family of the FALDS. The Texas Court of Appeals in May of 2008, the District Court of Appeals, and I'm not quite sure how it ended up in Austin, Texas. That's where the district court that issued this opinion came down with an opinion saying the state way exceeded their bounds here. They went way outside the statute. They had no basis to seize the vast majority of these children and ordered the child court or the trial court to return the children to their parents immediately. It took them about a week, but they eventually did. The state appealed that order. It is a non-published order, by the way. If you are a lawyer looking for it, you will have to find it on the internet or through Westlaw. I've got the Westlaw site if you're interested. The state appealed it to the Texas Supreme Court, and the Texas Supreme Court, in a case called In Re, Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, affirmed the appellate court in Austin and said, no, you got to turn these kids over. The state just way exceeded their authority. That opinion, if anybody wants to look at it, is at 255 Southwest 3rd, 613, Texas, 2008. So, all the kids, with the exception of a small number, I think the state hung on to about six for a while. They now, by this point in time, have returned all of the children. The one that took a little longer to return, some of you may have seen the news pictures that had a picture of Warren Jeffs giving this regrettably passionate kiss to a 12-year-old girl who he had married. That's the girl that kept in custody for the longest. I can't believe Warren did that. I mean, that just strikes me as... what are you thinking? That child, I believe, now has been placed with a family member of hers who is not affiliated with the FALDS Church at all. The others pretty much have gone back to their parents with the FALDS Church. Eventually, the state indicted six men for criminal charges. They have not been brought to trial yet. One of them is a doctor, and he was indicted for the crime of being aware of child abuse in children that he was examining, and I think it's primarily underage wives. And the law generally requires medical hospital staff and individual physicians to report child abuse when they see it. There's no patient-doctor privilege there, and you're required to report it. And this doctor didn't report it, so he's being prosecuted for that crime. The other men are all older men who had underage brides who are being criminally prosecuted for that. I think those trials are going to begin going this fall. They appointed the Attorney General of Texas to prosecute the cases rather than have the local district attorney prosecute them, probably because of the expense factor. I'm sure that the DA out there in this little West Texas town does not have a lot of resources, and this is probably going to be a pretty expensive trial for the state to prosecute. The last figure I read was that the state of Texas had spent $15 million to date on this. $15 million. And a good deal of that was for attorney's fees because they had to appoint attorneys to represent the children and the dependency proceedings. And then the parents had to write to counsel, and most of these people didn't have that. I'm sure there's going to be some fallout on that at some point because, you know, after the raid, of course, the economy collapses, and I'm sure that Texas's state revenues have cratered just like they have in other states. And the other thing was this county, as I said, the figures I've got are that in 2008, the ranch paid $424,000 in property taxes to the county, and that constituted 18% of the county's annual revenue. I'm assuming, I don't know what the valuation of that property is going to be now that all of this has played out. I'm sure that the FALDS will be arguing that the same valuation is not there and they shouldn't be paying the same rate of taxes. So I'm sure there's a huge fiscal hit on this county. All right, let me go to sort of lessons learned part of this, and then I'd like to leave, almost out of time, some time for some questions. I think both raids began with the mindset of some of the prosecutors of maybe this will make these people go away. We just don't like these people around. We don't like the life they live. They're embarrassing to us. Please go away. And if we prosecute you, we're going to make you go away. I can tell you from a lot of contact with this community, these people are not going away. You may drive them underground, and you may give them a lot less incentive to sort of be involved with the larger society, but this, you're not going to make them go away with these kind of criminal prosecutions. I suspect they figured that out fairly quickly in Texas, but Arizona did. The raids were both carried out in a way that suggested that the movers did a lot of advanced planning for this. It's clear that they did a lot of advanced planning in Texas, or I mean in Arizona. In Texas, you know, this was such a large operation, and they had the raid going up and going in there 5 days after they get the call. I cannot believe that somebody didn't have a contingency plan in place at some point to do something like this, sort of waiting for the call. There was just too much logistics assembled to do this immediately on the scale that they did it without there being some contingency planning. But the one contingency plan that neither state made was the cost. The cost just exploded on them, particularly on Texas immediately. And I just, I don't think the Texas authorities had any idea that this was going to end up costing them what it ended up costing them. I think they just went ahead and made their decisions without looking at the fiscal impact of what they did. I suspect that the raids were initiated partly because the movers were hoping to make the people who were the subject of the raid more like us, to dissuade them from their deviant, non-conforming ways, which I think is a problem we have in our society, not just on the fundamentalist Mormon front, but on a lot of fronts. We're a pluralistic society. There are going to be a lot of people out there who live their lives differently from us, and we just have to get used to that fact. If we want to have freedom ourselves, we've got to be prepared to allow other people the freedom to live differently, even if we just violently disagree with how they've chosen to live. The bad effect, I think, of this raid, particularly the Texas one, and certainly the 53 one, is it reinforces the paranoids. You know, if you've got the leader of some group, of these groups, talking about how evil the outside world is and how you shouldn't be involved in them and mistrustful of them, and I know they've had that debate going on down in Colorado City for a long time, a raid like this just reinforces those messages and underscores that the outside world is a dangerous place you shouldn't be involved in. If you want to modify the conduct of communities like this, you need to give them every opportunity to assimilate with the larger society, make them comfortable with dealing with social welfare agencies, comfortable with dealing with law enforcement, comfortable with having their kids in the public schools. You've got to make the world sort of open to them as opposed to a scary place that is going to cause them fear and harm. And I think the Texas raid absolutely had the opposite effect. Okay, with that, I'll shut up and try to leave some time for some questions. Yes?
Could you step up to the microphone over here and ask the question one more time?
I went longer than I had planned.
You know, you present a very optimistic view of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not overlook the abuses that exist there. When you talk about them assimilating and so on, I have a friend in that community. In fact, his little daughter is the girl that wrote the book, mm-hmm. Stolen Innocence. And I've talked to him about these issues. They seem to be comfortable about 50% of the people in the community taking food stamps and something like 60%+ being on Medicaid. And they don't seem to mind sending 400 of their young men out, the lost boys, for other people to take care of. And, you know, you take Warren Jeffs. That isn't the only 12-year-old I think he's been kissing. He inherited beautiful young wives that belonged to Warren Ruland Jeffs. He married a whole pass of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of things there that are very concerning, it seems to me, that need to be taken into consideration.
Well, let me make a couple of things perfectly clear. I don't think there's any protection for adult male involvement with underage girls. I don't think there's any legal protection whatsoever. It's not protected by the First Amendment or anything else. Those guys need to stop being involved with children, which is what somebody who is under the age of 18 is. I think it is built-in trouble for them. If there's any good thing that has come out of this series of events in Texas, is at least there is now a public pledge on their part not to engage in these marriages with people under the age of 18. And I hope they stick with that. Informally, I have told them for years, there is no protection here, and there is no outside public sympathy whatsoever for that. You need to stop it. I think that personally, I think the numbers may be overblown. I mean, I don't have any statistics to give to you. I've never been exposed to any, and I've certainly seen some underage girls getting ready to be married that I knew, and I was troubled by that. On the Lost Boys issue, My impression is the numbers that get thrown out on the Lost Boys are pretty over high. They're pretty inflated. I think I live in the South, the Deep South, you know, where you got a lot of Southern Baptists and Seventh-day Adventists and pretty socially conservative groups. And you get a lot of young men that burn out their communities and leave for conduct sort of issues. And I don't have any doubt that you got some of that going on down there. But the idea of kids getting kicked out solely for the purpose of freeing up young girls for old patriarchs, I just don't, my observations don't tell me that's going on down there.
Have you read the book?
Which book are you talking about?
Have you read Stolen Innocence?
I bought those books. I haven't read them yet. I just got asked to review them, so I'm going to have to start reading them soon.
You should.
But, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people down there in those different settings. And one other issue, you mentioned the food stamp, Medicaid kind of issue. You know, if people are eligible for those benefits and you don't like the fact that people are eligible for them, we need to change the benefits thing. Well, there needs to be some policing on that. I've been hearing that for a long time, and I've done some investigation of my own to try to verify it, including with the state agency down in St. George that is involved with that, and I never got any verification for widespread abuse. I don't have any doubt that there's some individual abuses going on, but I don't have the impression that it's a pattern.
As a young lawyer, a lot of years ago...
Excuse me, could you speak into the microphone so people can hear it on the tape?
I mean, it's been a practice in that community. Bleeding the beast is the way they look at it.
Now, I've heard that rhetoric,
government involvement. And, yeah. You know, the Kingstons, for example, in Davis County.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the Kingstons.
It doesn't matter. The principle's the same. Mm-hmm. They put their kids that they don't have, they in the past, they've actually put their children on welfare, the wives on welfare that didn't have a discernible husband, a legal husband. Mm-hmm. And I think those things happen in that community as well. But I think those statistics are pretty verifiable. More than 50% on food stamps and more than 60% on Medicaid. And I think that's a sad commentary on a community that wants independence.
Well, if you're talking about, if you don't think they should be eligible, you should change the eligibility law so that they don't receive it. And if they're eligible under the statutes, as their administrative rules as they're now in place, I don't know why you should treat them differently because you're not comfortable with their religious beliefs.
Does it bother you?
I wish they wouldn't do it, I'll put it that way, but I think, I still think the rules ought to be the same for everybody. And you shouldn't have one set of rules for this community because you don't like it, and a different set of rules for the part of the community that you do like, or that you're comfortable with. If you understand what I'm saying, I don't know how clear I'm being. But if they're legally eligible, they're legally eligible.
How sad is it?
Oh, come on.
Another question.
Let's take another question. I'll talk to you after we're done.
I would like to challenge you just a little bit about you kind of dismissing or making excuses for this community. You really can't know about child abuse because children naturally take the blame if they're being abused. You can only know when they grow up, and that you should dismiss this memory because they're grown up. That's pretty horrible.
Well, I don't know if you remember, but in the 1980s, there was a rash of these kinds of allegations. It was quite trendy with the mental health counseling community.
Yeah, I do remember that, but
still, and we sent a lot of innocent people to prison on stuff that didn't take place.
Yeah, and I remember that, but it's not an excuse for you.
No, I'm not saying it's an excuse. I'm telling you I'm extremely skeptical of lost memory refreshed kind of stuff.
Yes, but that's a different issue altogether. The people who, at that time, were people of two parents or people of a normal society. This society, by its very nature, is crippled. You know, they can't really try themselves on the society at large, and therefore they can't really grow.
Well, I mean, it sounds like, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but your answer sort of is, I want everybody to be like me.
No, not at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. It is the law of the land.
Is it? What's the law of the land that you're saying?
It is the law of the land that marriage is divine between a man and a woman.
Law of the land? Statutory law?
Law of the land. It is against the law to be married to more than one woman.
What's a marriage?
It doesn't really matter how you define it. if you're marrying kids...
If a religious community decides to define marriage...
I'm not going to fight with you. Promise you I'm not.
Now, I get this all the time. It's something I had to answer a lot in the interview.
But you don't take point of view of the society at large. The society at large, who is suffering from this?
I take the point of view of individual liberties. I think we each have the right to make decisions for ourselves. So that boils down to society gets to decide how we're all going to be. Somebody at the top says we're all going to be alike. We're going to structure
our
families and children.
America is a land of freedom.
Except for those people who disagree with your viewpoint.
No. You're not hearing me.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk afterwards? I'm going to stick around and I'll see if I can field some questions.
Just a couple of brief comments.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your presentation. I think the thing that appalls me so deeply about this is it's a reflection of Nazi Germany. I just can't believe that in the 21st century, in this country, we could have this many children ripped out of the arms of their parents and hauled in these yellow buses, Baptist buses. That's my second point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Baptists wanting to save the Mormons for Jesus. I can see that in these damn buses. I'm just appalled by all this. We've learned nothing from 52.
Mm-hmm.
Have we?
Well, they didn't learn it in West Texas.
I think the judge and the sheriff, and to bring a tank in there to blow the temple down to find the bodies? This is just kooky.
Yeah. Well, I'm also not here to say the government always makes the best decisions about how they handle
it. I actually just had a few comments that might be helpful clarification. I actually went to the 14-day hearing in Texas, and I was also present in Texas a couple of weeks after the children returned, and I was able to meet some of the families who lost their children in the raid. We're talking monogamous families, by the way, monogamous couples, young couples, couples who didn't know the other families in the ranch. There were many, many families at the ranch who did not know each other. And to wholesale yank all of those children because there was one or two who were married as minors was completely wrong and a blatant violation of every one of those people's rights. There were also women who were pregnant who were not minors, about 20 of them or 27 of them, who were kept in child custody, by the way, and treated as children because they were not able to convince the state officials that they were, in fact, adults. I don't know any woman in this room who would want to be kept as a foster child, as an adult pregnant woman. I don't know anyone who would want to do that. You cannot argue that this is justified based on some allegations. I have read your books. I'm familiar with all of that information. I just thought I would clarify some of those points.
Got another question? It's not a subject that people have mild opinions about.
Further comment or two on bleeding the beast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with the Colorado City Fire Department, having worked with the fire warden for our county for a few years. They have two full-time employees that work grants. And again, this is nothing illegal, but they're a very small rural community. They have a fire department that a medium-sized city would be jealous of.
I'm familiar with it.
And because it's all free.
Mm-hmm.
And the number one volunteer outlet for men in Colorado City is to be on the fire department. They have more trained people than the rest of Washington County put together. Their school district had their own plane. And when, I guess, Jeff's pulled all their people out of school, they kept the employees on the roll. It was later compared with some other similar-sized school districts. Their costs were 5 or 6 times or more. Mm-hmm. It's just... It seems to be a pattern of them taking everything they can, but no giving back to the community. And then a specific question. When Warren Jeffs was recently convicted for something like accomplice, the fellow who actually committed the crime that he was conspiring to help with, the the state didn't seem to have any interest at all.
I think he's been indicted. I think he's headed to a trial.
I heard he was after some outside people said, hey, wait a minute, you got Warren. What about the guy that you...
Well, they may be afraid that Warren's going to raise that as an issue on his appeal. His appeal's still pending, so that might be what that's about.
Mine is a comment. I apologize for not having a question, but as a historian, I always, at least my approach to history, is to look at parallels. Mm-hmm. And I'd like everyone in this audience to ask themselves this question. If an anonymous call came into the local police or the prosecutor's office of the county of say, Lancaster County, where the Amish mm-hmm. are heavily located, and a call came in claiming to be a teenage girl, 16 years of age or 14 years of age, claiming that her father in this Amish community was molesting her. Would you think, under any circumstances, that county would go in and arrest every family in the Amish community, even though they're strange, even though they're closed, even though they have very little, if anything, to do with the outside community? What's the difference? The difference is the sexual and cultural revulsion about Mormon polygamists. Mm-hmm.
I think that's true, although I would say the one little distinction is because of the communal setting here might give the state a little more. They certainly made that argument, but I don't disagree with your comment.
Mine is more of a statement, too. Even if pro or con, even if all the things that they were doing was wrong, it still seems scary to me how their civil liberties were completely disregarded and they weren't treated the same as everybody else. And it makes me think, could it set a precedent where maybe somebody doesn't like somebody's political views or something like that, and they're going to take their children away because they said it's child abuse to teach your children a certain political view.
I don't think the Texas case will end up being precedent for anything like that because it's so blew up in their faces. I don't think anybody's going to model that.
This is a question. I think Mark Shurtleff, the Attorney General of the state of Utah, has gone to extraordinary lengths to avoid charging any consenting adult polygamist practitioners in the state of Utah. I mean, the last one that didn't have any children involved was Mark Easterday in 1999, and that went nowhere. So do you think Mark Shurtleff maybe shot himself in the foot when he went to Texas and encouraged Texas to be aggressive with the fundamentalist Mormons there, resulting in a situation now where one of these men who's been indicted, I think his name is Wendell something, is being charged with bigamy and never had any relationships with anyone who was a minor?
Well, I can't speak to what kind of communication Shurtleff had with Texas. The only thing I feel like I do know is that he encouraged them to change their statute relating to the statutory rape or the age of consent in Texas. I think they raised it from 14 to 16, which had an effect on prosecutions that may come out of this. Let me just try to address one. I know we're probably over time.
I have.
We need to stop.
Got a minute or two.
About marriage. We got a little bit of comment about that. The United States Supreme Court in the early 2000s, I think 2002, decided a case out of Texas. It frequently gets called the gay sex case, but it's Lawrence versus Texas. And what the Supreme Court said is it decriminalizes sexual conduct between consenting adults. You may not criminally prosecute adults who choose to engage in this conduct, any conduct. And it specifically says children are not covered by this. I mean, the opinion specifically draws a line on children. So I think unless the Supreme Court has a change of heart, I think the criminal prosecution of consenting adults in a sexual relationship is closed. But Utah's got this kind of odd bigamy statute. There are two kinds of bigamy statutes around the country. One is the fraud model, where his wife number one doesn't know about wife number two. There's a fraudulent aspect to this. And you're going down and you're taking out multiple marriage licenses and you're filling them out in a way that indicates I don't have another pre-existing spouse. You're cheating somebody and you're cheating the state. Utah and a minority of other states, including Texas, have a kind of a patent or trademark version of bigamy where they say, we are the state. Only us get to use the word marriage. You may not use the word marriage in your relationships. And if you purport, that's the legal word they use, to perform a marriage with another spouse existing, that constitutes the crime of bigamy. So under Utah law, you can go shack up with somebody in a weekend, you know, and have a totally meaningless sexual relationship and offer no responsibility for each other in the future, and that's not criminal. But if you then say, I marry you, then you've committed a crime. That strikes me as insane public policy, but that's the way the law sort of falls out in Utah. So with religious communities like this, or any community, the question becomes, what's a marriage? Do you feel like you need to involve the state in your relationships, or is marriage a kind of a contractual agreement relationship between the parties? And originally, that's the way we viewed marriage in this country. It was between you and God and the church. The government wasn't involved in it. The government really didn't get involved in the regulation of marriage until the Mormons came along. And everybody got upset about the Mormons and invited the government into the tent of marriage. And now we have a situation where the government is essentially calling the shots on what's a marriage. Personally, from a philosophical standpoint, I think that's a bad thing, but that's where we're at now. So the legal situation on plural marriages is pretty messy right now. But I think just because you say you are married doesn't mean it's a criminal violation. Thank you very much.
I realize we're at the end of the session, but I did actually have a question myself, and
sure.
You jumped in and started answering the questions before I got a chance, and that's chairing the session. I get to ask my question. I was wondering if the raid that happened in Texas, it appeared that they didn't know that they were coming, and they came in at 9 o'clock at night. There was no pre-warning or anything. Is that
right? I've not seen or heard anything that suggests to me they had a warning, but they were blindsided.
How would you contrast that to how they were prepared in the 52 raid and how they gathered in the square? Would you think in today's times they might have had the same kind of response, or would they have?
I would have expected a similar kind of response. Well, I mean, where are you going to run to out there? I wouldn't have expected a violent or resistive response, if that's what you're saying. People are angry, mm-hmm. but I don't think that means they're going to go get a shotgun and meet you in the alley. And I think when the Texas authorities came in armed up expecting a assault kind of response was just a complete misreading of the community.
Okay, we want to thank Ken for his time and did an excellent presentation today.
Thank you.